We gather today beneath the shadow of death, yet that shadow is thin. Donald Dean Davis, known to many as Gabby, left us on April 14th, 4 months ago. His memory, though, lives on. And that is what we come together to celebrate this afternoon. We commit to the preciousness of memory, a life mingled with our own. Those whom we love do indeed leave us, and when we lose them, no spoken word can lessen the grief. But what they were can never leave us. The strength of their presence, the gentleness of their sympathy, the warmth of their love, these are ours always, interfused with our thoughts and blended with our lives. I welcome each of you here, recognizing that your bonds run deep. We come in solidarity, especially with those who love Don most, his children, Donna and Dan, and his grandchildren. We recognize that not all those who loved him, including some grandchildren, could be present, so our love is extended to all those, present and absent, who feel the loss of Don. We cannot help but remember in these moments other losses that have come before, particularly of Don's beloved and vibrant wife, Jean, who shared his connection with this fellowship. Let us be honest with death. Let us not pretend that it's less than it is. It is separation. It is sorrow. It is grief. And for Don, it is an end to a slow decline that stole from him his vision, his hearing, his thinking, his mobility, and though he fought to maintain it right up to the end, his independence. So let us neither pretend that death is more than it is. Death is not annihilation. Whatever our differing views of the afterlife, I am sure that the great abiding love of the universe embraces Don. He lives on as long as memory endures. His influence continues to be felt. His death is not an end to love. Our love for him does not end, and our need for love from one another is boundless. Death is not an end to joy and laughter. Nothing would less honor his soul than to make our lives drab on his account. So I welcome you here this afternoon with your memories and your stories. These are the core of our time together, which we begin with the lighting of the chalice. And words by David Eaton. All living substance, all substance of energy, being, and purpose are united and share the same destiny. All people, those we love and those we know not of, are united and share the same destiny, birth to death. We share this unity with the sun, earth, our brothers and sisters, strangers, flowers of the field, snowflakes, volcanoes, and moonbeams. Birth, life, death, unknown, known, unknown. Our destiny from unknown to unknown. May we have faith to accept this mystery and build upon its everlasting truth. I did not know Don until the last couple of years when I met and visited with him at Meadowlark Hills. He was always up and about, engaged, connecting, doing. He wanted to come back to the fellowship, he said, but he couldn't see or hear well, and his old friends were almost all gone. And that is one of the tragedies of living such a long life. Besides his productive career, Don had loved being a small-town athlete, a baseball player, and his life deeply entwined with his wife, Jean, who took care of him until he had to take care of her. He had some skill with woodworking, but mostly with people. Ever open-minded and practical, he strove to connect with others and forge his own path. He has moved on to the next adventure. I offer words from Robinson Jeffers. I am not dead. I have only become inhuman. That is to say, undressed myself of laughable prides and infirmities, but not as a man undresses to creep into bed, but like an athlete stripping for the race. The delicate ravel of nerves that made me a measurer of certain fictions called good and evil, that made me contract with pain and expand with pleasure, fussily adjusted like a little electroscope, that's gone, it is true. I never miss it. If the universe does, how easily replaced. But all the rest is heightened, widened, set free. I admired the beauty while I was human. Now I am part of the beauty. I wander in the air, being mostly gas and water, and flow in the ocean. Touch you and Asia at the same moment. Have a hand in the sunrises and the glow of the grass. I left the light precipitate of ashes to earth for a love token. And Don's son, Dan, will now offer remembrances.
Thank you for coming. Dad would have appreciated it. We talked about this time, and it would have mattered to him. And I would be way at a loss to Donna, the past years working with you, with Dad and Mom. You're a champ. It's just been wonderful. I love you. And Nancy, since I'm talking, this talk turned out to be about words. I started to do some arithmetic and realized that you and I have told each other I love you over 200,000 times. I love you dearly. And all of you who made time to help Dad and to be a part of his life, but particularly at the end, who made time for Dad. And I know how difficult that is. I know my own failings with my friends who are older. But I've watched Bill Pallett. I would think about, I would hear Dad's side of the story toward the end when Bill and Dad would spend the days watching ball games, and I would just think how it was. And Joe and the folks up on the ridge who always, I would listen to the story as he came back that time you had the storm when you went to get the meat and try to make sense of what was going on as you were trying to. And I guess I had never, I've never believed much in angels, but, you know, if somebody started with beautiful blonde and from Poland, I probably would start to listen to that. But thank you for coming. It would be important to him. It was important for him to make a difference, to matter in the world. He wanted to make the world a better place. He struggled when he changed from being a coach and counselor, where he could know the people that he was affecting, to his more removed role as a representative of ACT. He often stated that he was trying to help individual college advisors use the tools that ACT provided to assist students in using their college careers to find a personally meaning and satisfying life. He badly needed to justify his work as positive in individual lives. And this is my chance as his son and confidant to publicly acknowledge and praise his contributions to America and humanity, to talk about the difference that he did make. He was born in 1924, so he came into awareness as the Great Depression began and grew. His father used to tell the story with very specific numbers of turning down an offer in the late 20s for his bins full of oats and corn and wheat, only to watch the prices collapse along with his farming dream. So in his earliest years, Dad's family battled out an existence as town folks while the Depression and 1930s weather strangled the middle of the United States. Just try to imagine making a living as a dry cleaner in Burr Oak, Kansas in the Depression. Times were tough. Dad's father, a hard-working World War I vet, used alcohol to take the edge off, and with all the family drama that comes with overindulgence. His much-beloved grandfather Fogo's farm was a warm refuge for him as a youngster. But his grandfather, who was a successful farmer and a member of the board of the local bank, was overextended going into the Depression. His grandparents were aging. They lost the farm and passed while he was still young. Times were tough. His passion was for sports. He loved football, baseball, hunting, and fishing. He used to tell me about a boarder they had who had an exhausting job, but who would play catch with him as a little 6- and 7- and 8-year-old boy when he came home. He told me a story several times about being frustrated because he was working on the farm and no one would go to the game on Saturday night. He was 10 years old and he took off. It was many miles to town, took off walking. And finally his uncle came along and went, "Get in," and took him into town. He trapped skunks in high school for money. And we used to tell us that when we were young. And we would go, he'd go, "They only sprayed me once. You had to come back." And you think about sitting in high school beside somebody who trapped skunks. Later in life, I would ask him and he would say, "Yeah, I probably smelled bad most of the time." Times were so different. They would get in an old car and start from Mankato and drive to Beloit. The young high school boys, a lot the way. I mean, we'd go out to, you know, out there toward Hunter, out in the Blue Hills, but they would drive toward Beloit and shoot rabbits on the way and take them down to what became Clarkie's place and sell the rabbits and get enough money for gas and shotgun shells to go back and start over again. Those were his passions. It is what made him who he was and helped him make a difference in the world. He grew up in an all-white world. It was not that way by accident. He used to tell me about seeing his first person with dark skin when he was in Salina as about a 6-year-old with his mother, a wonderful woman who was a pillar of the church. As he stared at this person, she grabbed him and spun him around and told him, "Don't look at them, they stink." He used to wonder if his father had been in the Klan. His father certainly associated with that sort of people. Dad could have absorbed that pool hall attitude and vernacular, but I believe sports is a lot of what saved him from that. He was physically active and outside and blessed with coaching mentors like Bus Boyd and Dennis McKee, who believed in fairness and sportsmanship. As he was in high school, World War II broke out. In fact, he was hunting at the Jamestown Reservoir when a passerby told him that Pearl Harbor had happened. As high school ended, he had a life-changing adventure because of his sports attitude. He got a job. He went to play ball and got a job in Fort Scott working in a cement plant. Mostly what they were doing was feeding the boilers, shoveling coal. And so he worked with people of color, black guys doing that. And they took him in and took him home, and he realized they were human beings, that these people were not what he had heard from his parents. And I like to think of this gung-ho kid and how those guys must have thought, what is this white boy that's come here anyway? And His sense of fairness and decency was strongly reinforced there. World War II spun him out into the world on many adventures, but my favorite stories were about his riding the beach, patrolling the beach in Georgia. He fell in with an old black guy named Tom, of course, who hustled the military base for scraps to make his life livable. And Dad used to tell the story about telling Tom, "I'll get you some boots, Tom. What size do you wear?" And Tom said, "Donnie D, anything from an 8 to an 11. Times were tougher, you know, to be a black guy in Georgia than they were in Burr Oak. Think about wearing shoes that. But Tom was a fisherman, and so Dad had found a fishing partner. And I grew up sitting on the Republican River sandbars listening to advice that Tom had handed down to Dad, how to deal with mosquitoes, where to put the light at night. It still always amazes me that a Gula-speaking man from the Sea Islands, always one of our nation's most remote spots, especially after the Civil War when the plantations were abandoned, and a kid from one of the whitest places in our nation would find each other because of a mutual love for fishing. By the end of the war, he was an adult with decisions to make. His skipper offered to sponsor him if he wanted to stay in the service, and his uncle offered to back him if he wanted to farm. Dad was convinced that he could get a degree and play ball at Fort Hays State College. He turned down both of those offers, and once again, his love of sports pushed him in what seemed later to be a positive direction. He enrolled at Hays and quickly began growing a family in those pre-birth control days. He could make it as college because the GI Bill supplemented his side work. They could survive on that small amount of money by living in a fiberboard-walled old army barracks that adjoined the football field. He must have been a gung-ho and personable guy, as evidenced by his size as a lineman. You see that picture out here and imagine him playing college ball, even then, and his election as president of the Letterman's Club. He graduated and accepted a teaching and coaching job at Smith Center, beginning a very important and gratifying time in his life. Smith Center, Kansas, in the 1950s, was idyllic. We had freedom. Doors were unlocked. We had freedom to roam. There were not huge income differences. Doctors lived beside teachers. The banker lived beside the guy who ran the gas station. Law enforcement was Forby Dillsaver, a genial old guy that used to lean on the shady side bank wall and keep an eye out for kids driving bicycles on the downtown Main Street. But it was an idyllic time. The thing that I want to emphasize about Don Davis during this time, exemplifies the way that he made a difference in the world. There was no derogatory language in our house, ever. There was no derogatory language in the homes that we were in. I think particularly of the Hoopers and the Hills. But all of the homes that we were in, that we neighbored in, there was none. That would have been jarringly obvious. I was old enough to be able to remember when I asked what the sign in Paul's Diner meant that said, "We reserve the right to refuse service to anyone." I was immediately informed by the man sitting at the counter that it meant no niggers. I can remember where I stood. Stunning to hear that. What? I had no idea. I can remember where I stood and who asked how I could drink a Coke out of the bottle when a nigger might have used it before me. What? Those ideas were not in our home. How could that make sense? And that may seem like a small thing, but it's really quite large. We live in a time when that has come to be called political correctness, polite language about other people. I believe it was a reflection of the decency and kindness of those people in that time. World War II had stirred our population, but its effect was much greater than that. It was a war against probably the most brutally racist society to have ever existed, and that colored our thinking and helped lead to civil rights changes like Brown versus Board and voter registration drive. A total existential war had made us much more of a merit-based society. You can read the memoirs and stories of the people in that war, and what family you were from or whose friend you were just paled as the thing that mattered was, could you perform the task at hand, whether it was D-Day, going into Africa, whether it was in Washington. People with merit moved up. That attitude and that stirring and the post-war government's appreciation programs for those soldiers changed many citizens' social status, including dads, and it led to huge changes in our society. I want to emphasize this lack of derogatory language in Don and Jean Davis's home, because that is where I'm trying to drive this ramble about how Dad made a difference in the world. 1950s North Central Kansas was idyllic in some ways, but horrific in others. There were what were called sundown laws, and I can remember being told that it is against the law for a nigger to stay in this town overnight. And I thought at the time, I don't really believe there is such a law, but I realize now that the law does not need to be written down if that segment of the population that has hate inside of them believes in such a law and has no worry about law enforcement interference. Dad, all of us, were ignorant, we were isolated, we were blind in retrospect, but Dad fundamentally believed in the equality of human beings. I can remember being about a fourth grader when queer became a cute word. I was on to queer. That's queer. You're queer. It became a big favorite word of mine. Dad asked me if I knew what it meant. I said, sure. It means odd, weird. And he sat me down and told me, no, that means two people, two men or two women, who love each other. And I was shocked. I had never even heard of such a thing. But what I remember, that was thousands of years before anything like sexual identity equality was even a thing. But Dad explained homosexuality to me without derogatory baggage or overtones, because of his basic decency and morality. We've all had our feelings hurt as we have been corrected about the hurtfulness in our language. And there have certainly been paid media voices deriding political correctness because they know that telling people that hurtful language is acceptable increases ratings and sells advertising. But language is important. When we use that hurtful language, it matters. We are telling our children and our friends that we think other people are lesser beings. And it signals to people with hate inside them and anger that their actions are okay. Dad's decency and morality came a lot from his involvement in sports. Think how easy it would have been to fall into derogatory language and thinking if you're a poor kid wanting to matter in the world. He chose to emulate kinder and more decent and more self-confident men. He had another trait besides his decency that helped him impact the world. He could change. Even as an adult, he could change. And Lord, he was powerful, stubborn. But when confronted with the obvious, he could change his outlook and actions. We got our first television set in 1960, in time for the presidential conventions. And of course, we were Republicans. We were from North Central Kansas. Democrats were city people and hate-spewing Southerners. But Dad often referred back to those conventions as a turning point for him. He used to say that he looked and he realized, watching the delegates, that the Democrats looked more like him and his friends than the Republicans. That was the decade of the Civil Rights Act, and as Lyndon said, the Democratic Party was destroyed in the South. But as the political parties changed, which would be the home of the people who were frightened of different kinds of people, Dad shed his identity as a Republican. This is not an easy thing to do as an adult. We watch a dramatic example in our present time as scientific, repeatable experimentation shows that our globe's climate is changing. But people who do not want to believe that use ever more elaborate justifications or just ignore data because they cannot open their minds to change. Without being able to change, he might never have been able to be part of that group of people that met up here on the lake in Manhattan in the evenings, which to me is almost idyllic, to think of you people sitting around and having a beer in the evening with those people. And Dad would also, and those like-minded people that he and Mother were comfortable with and could be different and could argue and feel comfortable in a place where I know derogatory language is not used. Dad would also sit with the coffee crowd as he aged. He was never a major contributor to conversations, and of course his ability to take part became increasingly fragile as he aged. He would tell me about the things that he had heard and how horrified he was. I sat with him a few times, and it was pretty amazing, the irresponsible and irrational verbiage spewed by many of his contemporaries. It is damned amazing to listen to people who have lived their lives and careers in a clean, comfortable town built on government money in a state that is high on the list of per capita federal largest, and whose careers were often dependent on federal dollars, and they spew about how terrible the government is. I listened to a contemporary of his call for a bomb on the nation's capital as we sat within a few miles of where the bomb was made that blew up the Murrow Building. Just talk, people say. It's just talk. It's just talk by people who feel small and want to talk big. Old men claiming to have made it by damn on their own, ignoring their parents, their society, their education, their luck. And I felt thankful. I was thankful that my dad was not like that. Thankful that my dad was decent on the inside. Thankful that my dad tried hard not to use hurtful and hateful language. Thankful that my dad was strong enough to make it out of a tough situation and not forget that he had some help along the way. Thankful that my dad was not afraid of people who were different from him. And thankful that my dad tried not to categorize people. Thankful that my dad could be open to change. And if he was just a small man, as we are all small people, and if his contribution was a small particle in the vastness of humanity, he tried to listen to the better angels of his nature and to make the world a little better. And I thank him for that.
At this time, I invite stories and remembrances sharing from others, and Ada or Katie is going to get the mic and bring it around. So please speak directly into the mic like this. Raise your hand. Let us know who wants to talk.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Oldfather, and I'm a member here at the Fellowship. And about 17, 18 years ago, we built on this segment of the building, this new addition. And after the basics were done, a call went out that we sure would like to build a stage area. And who could come help. And Don was first in line to help that day and helped all day. And I don't think it was kind of a hard time for him physically, I think, because he had to take a lot of little breaks. But he stayed with it, and it was just made a big impression on me because he hadn't been that active, but he came to help that day with a job with other people, and that's when I first got to know him. And then I visited with him a lot at Meadowlark over the years and learned a lot about him and from him. And the thing I remember most is he always told me that he lives in his memories now, that he loved to spend time thinking about his past and his memories of his life. And I found that kind of comforting, to know that at the end of your life you spend a lot of time thinking about all the great things and moments you had. So I'm really glad I got to know him.
Hi, I'm Vance Terrell, and Donnie was my uncle. I have a couple of stories to tell. First of all, one of the things that I think Danny forgot to tell was the patience that the Davises at my grandpa and grandma's learned at Christmas time, as we would all sit there eagerly anticipating Christmas to be here, but we couldn't do anything because the Myers were a few hours behind time. John had got stopped by a farmer, and he had to go out and do something with the pigs or the cows or something. The second one is we lived in Manhattan, and Donnie and Gene actually helped us find a house. We moved from Iowa State down here just as school was starting. When I finally got a job at Hutch Community College, and the next year, my wife, when she was in Manhattan, she worked at an airplane factory for one day, sent me back to get the paycheck because we needed it that bad. But when we went to Hutchinson, it happened to be mentioned that Uncle Donnie had gone on vacation, correct? And he wanted to know, perhaps he knew Kathy was, we were needing the money and she didn't have a job. So he said, would you possibly come down to my office and, you know, just kind of answer the phone for a couple of hours a day? And I think that lasted 2 or 3 days. That was the complete of the job. But when we got to Hutchinson, the dean of students down there happened to know Uncle Donnie from ACT. And when he found out that he was my uncle and Kathy's uncle, and Kathy said, well, yes, I work for him up there. Well, immediately, and this was in days and times, but I was the one called into the president's office with the deans and so forth, and they announced to me that they were going to give my wife the job as financial aid director at Hutchinson Community College. And it was a big deal, and the reason she got the job was because of our Uncle Donnie.
I might speak twice because I'm also going to invite people for cookies later. But there's one. I thought there would be maybe more Smith Center High School football players here. Keith is here. He'll like this story. And some of my Nebraska-loving relatives might like this story, or they might not. But Aunt Barb might know the exact date, but when did K-State beat Nebraska at Nebraska?
1968.
So Aunt Barb's brother, who was a banker in Nebraska, in Lincoln, got us tickets right in the middle of all the big red people. And that was back when K-State did not win ball games. Now, my Uncle Lefty was there with my dad, and I had a date. It turned into not being the best date of my life, but anyway, beer was involved. And K-State was doing well. And my dad kept wanting to stand up in the middle of all these red shirts and say, "What's the score, Big Red?" And Lawrence would say, "Not yet, Davis, not yet." Finally, more beer is involved, and K-State's still, it looks, we're going to win. So Lawrence goes, "Now, Davis, now," and he stood up, and started saying, I haven't felt this good since Smith Center beat Stockton back in 1950-something. Anyway, we had to sort of corral him in the back of a car, didn't we? Because he went all around Lincoln. What's the score, Big Red? So he was a K-State fan.
Sorry. My name's Booker Davis, and I'm one of the grandkids here, along with Ada. And my sister, she lives in Colorado. She couldn't make it. My brother, he's working right now. He'll be here later as soon as he's off. But on in a similar vein to what my Aunt Donna was just talking about, I grew up with, as my dad described, a grandfather who was never raised his voice, you know, to me once, always showed just infinite patience. You know, he taught me. He tried to teach me. He'd been a driving instructor for a while, and he tried to teach me how to drive on his golf cart. And I was a little young for that. There's a couple of incidences that occurred. Maybe some things got ran over, and it was another year before I was allowed to drive the golf cart again. But one of my favorite memories of him is. I was in football, and we were up in this little tiny high school, Midway Denton. It is middle of nowhere, and we weren't very good. We were never very good, but we really weren't that good this year, and they were very good. They had, if I remember, they'd beaten every team by the mercy rule before halftime, And we were no exception, and they had a star player, Darren Roberts, that was his name, I still remember that, and they were up by 60 points at least at this point, you know, it was bad, and you know, I was on the sideline, and our sideline was pretty quiet, there weren't many people there in the first place, and we didn't have anything to really cheer about. And their star player, all of a sudden, he went down with an injury. And, you know, so then it got really quiet on both sides. Except on our sidelines, suddenly there was this scream, this yell, and laced with profanities. And everybody turned around, serves you right for leaving him. And there's my granddad, all 140 pounds of him, wet and wearing boots, out like almost coming over the fence, screaming at the other team that it served him right for leaving their player in that long. And this was the first time I'd ever heard him yell. I was shocked. Everybody was kind of shocked at this point. And he calmed down after a while, but that was, I think in my life, that was the only time I ever heard him yell. And you were talking about sportsmanship and everything earlier, and that just shows you how much he believed in that and fairness. And you could fire him up, though, if need be.
One of the...
Just talk into it. Okay. Just
One of the hardest I ever heard him speak was when McPeak drove on his grass. Pulled up on the grass he planted. I was, all right, doesn't matter. That's about as harsh as I ever heard him. I can always still remember that because I was pretty shocked.
I'm the lone survivor of the Smith Center Red Men football team. And my freshman, and we were neighbors with Danny Jim and Donna Jean. And Gabby was never Don, it was Gabby. We were there, I don't know how many years you were there, but my freshman and sophomore year, he was our coach. And I never would have believed that he weighed 150 pounds, because he was 150 pounds of sheer muscle. And I will tell you that, and I weighed 180 pounds as a freshman, and the linemen were about that, up to 190. And if he didn't like the way we were blocking, he had a helmet, and he would put his helmet on, and he would say, see if you can hold me out, you know. And he had a thing called the forearm shiver, which is totally illegal now. But he would come up with that thing like that and knock all of us on our butt. I mean, and so he was very involved with us. That's the first story. The second story is I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Philippines, and I met and married a beautiful lady. Her name was Paterna. She was a teacher in the Philippines in math in the high school. We came back here, and Don was talking about the black problem. Well, also there was a problem with she couldn't find a job because, you know, not because of her race, but because they just weren't sure about her. Gabby took her under his wing, and she was summa cum laude at the university that she's at, and she taught 7 years. He carted her down to the Kansas Department of Education with her transcripts, and kind of led the way. And within 3 weeks, she had a teacher certificate, and she taught then in Waterville, Kansas, while I was going to grad school here. So, those are my stories.
We want it on the mic so that it gets recorded for the family.
I'm Pat McKee, and I've just been sitting here the whole time. My father-in-law, Dennis McKee, was Gabby's teacher somewhere along the line. Mentor, football coach, on and on and on. But I can remember Red Huffman was the football coach at Fort Hays State, and my father-in-law was the Hays High football coach. But they were together one time around the table, and my mother-in-law was a phenomenal cook. Everyone who ever ate at her house talked about her cooking for years because everything was from scratch. But anyway, talking about how Gabby got his name, and I kept waiting for someone to tell that story, but I'm afraid I'll get it wrong. But Red and my father-in-law, Dennis McKee, were talking about how they played cards and they were trying to get him to shut up. And finally someone said, brought up the name Gabby, and everyone fell over laughing, and it stuck. Now, I may have that story wrong, but I do know it all came about from a game of cards and how those two guys were talking. You know, somebody was trying to get a word in edgewise, and he was just a kid, and he was just talking nonstop. Is that story wrong or right now?
He would never tell where that story came from.
No, it came from a card game, and they were all trying to talk, and he wouldn't let anybody have a word in edgewise, and finally Jay just said, you know, Gabby, and then it stuck. From then on out, his name was Gabby Davis.
I'm Skip Bishop, and my husband Doyle, and we're from the Democrat Ridge, where Don and Jean lived for, I don't know, 10 years, 12 years. I'm one of the queers that Dan was told about, and I was so appreciative of Don and Jean accepting Doyle and I, and so appreciative of just his warm love and support. And in that line, it has allowed my husband and I to be more open in our communities. And since we lived out at the lake, we've moved to Council Grove, and we're probably the only out couple in Council Grove. It doesn't matter. And one of the reasons why it doesn't matter to me anymore is because of our friendship with Don and Jean and Democrat Ridge. It was a wonderful experience knowing Don, and I'm sorry I didn't get to see more of him. I don't know how many of you read my Facebook page, and I just really miss the son of a bitch. And when you talked about strength when he was a coach, I remember he was in the hospital for some testing or something, and he couldn't get over how the nurses flirted with him. He was 80 years old, and they couldn't believe an 80-year-old man could have a six-pack. He was strong until I don't know, Dan, until he died, probably. But I just really appreciate being able to have known him and have known Gene. And one of the things that surprised me, especially about Gene, and I know Doyle keeps telling me that I came to Gene's service here, but I don't remember it. I have memory issues. But Gene always remembered who I was, even with her Alzheimer's, and that always surprised me. And that I also appreciate, but I'll never forget Don or Gene.
I'd like to ask if those of you who went to those garage door parties that we had across the street and sampled some of the purple beer that Gene loved and I didn't. They talked me into drinking some once, and I said, oh, how nice, and never again. Bye. That was bad stuff. Anyhow, I've just, during the last month and a half, have wondered how the conversations in front of the garage would have changed. Gene would probably be most vocal about what was happening politically, and Don would also join in, I'm sure, but there wouldn't be much approval going on, I think.
Let's hear from the person with the mic.
It was blueberry beer, and I did enjoy it almost every evening at Don and Gene's house. And after Gene died, we were getting together for one of our dinners, and Don at that time couldn't drive, and he was at Meadowlark. He walked all the way down to the liquor store, bought two bottles of blueberry beer, brought them out to our place in Gene's honor. And we have one of those beers yet. And we're holding on to it because it reminds us of Gene and Don.
Hi. I'm a Democrat Ridge member. There were four families that lived...
Bring the mic up. Yeah.
There were four families that lived actually in a square. And Don named it Democrat Ridge. I moved to Manhattan in... 2005, and I saw Don, and he had a bumper sticker said Riley County Democrats, and he was out walking around, and I said, I rolled down the window, and I'd not met him, and I said, I like your bumper sticker, and I'll talk to you later. So, and I got back home, and he came over and welcomed us to the neighborhood, and then so Skip and Doyle and Mike and Richard were there, and Barb and I, and Don and Gene, that's, my dad had died, oh, I don't know, maybe 10 years before that, and not that Don was like a father to me, but in some ways he was, and I enjoyed his company more than about anybody that I have ever known. I know you guys know. Anyway, but we go wood cutting together, and... we talk politics, and I guess we were on the same page. It does make a difference. But we went woodcutting one time, and we had permission from this guy, had a big section, and it had locust and hedge trees, which he wanted to have them cut down. And so we would take the ones down, or we'd cut the ones on the ground, and Don was always, toward the end of this, because we did this for two or three or four years, And Don would take his chainsaw, but toward the end, I would chainsaw, and he'd be cleaning up brush. Well, he'd pulling on this locust tree, and it had a sticker in it. And so the sticker, he's pulling, and the branch snaps back, and it goes through his leg, in a big, long locust. I don't know if you know about the locust sticker. Big, long locust sticker. So, and I'm thinking, oh. So I'm thinking, well, we need to do something about this immediately. So I got some tools, and we cut off the sticker and took his overalls or his pants down, and then I just happened to have a little bit of medicinal vodka in the car, and I poured it over the wound and pulled the sticker out with a pair of pliers, and it looked kind of, I mean, those things are poisonous, and it looked kind of nasty. And I said, "Don, we need to get back to town." And he says, "No, we got wood to cut." That's just the way. I kept trying to say, "Don, it's a fairly deep wound." He said, "Well, we'll see how it goes, but you know, it's not going to make a difference." But anyway, he had an eye cancer thing, and he had a clinic in Kansas City that he'd go to, and Gene didn't feel comfortable, and Don couldn't, and I just ended up driving down there. I had never had so much fun with two people in my life. Could we talk all the way down? And Don, we mostly talk politics. Once again, we're kind of on the same page. Don, we'd be talking about someone in past Kansas politics. It could be 20 or 30 years ago. And he said, "Give me a minute, I'll get to it. Give me a minute, I'll get to it." And he'd get quiet, and then in a minute or 2 minutes, he would remember the name of the person we were talking about and the event we were talking about. And he was amazing. He was an amazing friend. We did stuff lots of times, just little tiny things, and I don't know, for 4 or 5 years, he's the best neighbor I ever had, and I just loved him to death, and we'd talk every day, just some little thing, and just say hi. But
your ridge, the openness between those people, was much like Smithson.
Well, yes. But where can you find? Where can you find four in Riley County? It's hard to find four families within this contagious area that are all kind of on the same page. And I thought, I've gone to heaven. Anyway, I'm pretty much done.
Did you start building a wall?
No. No. No, we get along pretty well, actually.
So my name is Majka Jankowiak. This is my husband, Ryszard. We are from Poland. So it was... Actually, Don was the first person I met in Kansas, the first Kansan. You know, we just moved in. He came by the next day to greet us. Also, lots of information about local services. He wanted to be helpful. He wanted also to make sure that we use particular trash companies so the street is safer, you know. And so very quickly we became good friends. And then when we befriended Barb and Joe and Skip and Doyle, then we just were together, many dinners together, many conversations in the garage, on streets. So it's very, very special. I feel very fortunate that I have met Don and Gene, and it's like, for me, this is the essence of humanity in the best way, you know, the honesty, the fairness, love, and friendship. So very, very happy that they were part of our lives.
Maybe I'll say something. I recently completed my degree in law and governance, and I like to credit my grandpa for getting me into that field. One of the memories that I have was being drug out to a Kathleen Sebelius rally when she was getting running for election, and had a big sign that I larger than me, and so I would carry the stick. Grandpa had the upper corner, kind of keeping me from tipping over, and you could say I didn't have the chance to change to Democrat. Grandpa made sure I was that from the very beginning. You know, as time went on with him, his eyesight failed, his hearing failed, and one of the things that when he was really unable to see was I was worried sometimes he wouldn't recognize me. I would come up and he wouldn't be able to tell who I was from up close. So I started wearing red lipstick every time I would go and see him. And so whenever I wear red lipstick, he would be able to see my face and say, "Oh, wow, what a pretty color you're wearing today." And so that was how he would recognize me. And so now whenever I wear red lipstick, I always think of my grandpa. And one of the last coherent conversations him and I had was after I had just completed my master's degree. And I said, "You know, Grandpa, I'm not sure what I should do next. Should I go? Should I get a job? Should I take some time off? I feel like I've been doing school for a long time. I kind of want a break, you know. I want to do my PhD eventually, but maybe now's not the right time." And he said, "You know, kid, just keep going." And so I'm starting my PhD in the fall, and I have him to thank for that, so.
Are there any others? Donna, did you want to? Donna's going to wind up.
So before I say the last story, I need to ask Keith, were you on the team that beat Stockton? Back in. I want to, on a more serious note, but that was one of my most memorable dates ever.
Sure.
With the mic, please.
Oh, yeah, well, for the recording.
We're taping it for the grand.
When we would go to football games, my dad was the grade school coach. And Gabby was a high school coach. He took over from my dad, who was a high school coach, and then decided that we wanted to farm, and then we went out to the country. But anyway, now they have these nice buses, and then they've got a bus driver, and then, all this kind of stuff. Guess who the bus driver was when they played football? Wally Hooper and Gabby Davis. Now you get money when you take tickets. You know, that's an extracurricular activity. Guess who took tickets? My mom and her mom, and for nothing, you know? So times have changed.
He was pretty stunned when he went out there last time and saw the football facility. Oh, yeah.
No, just one final thing. When he wanted to make a difference, and people talk about how, as individuals, my best friend in high school was not a stellar student, and she knew it. She didn't do well on her ACT test, but all she wanted to do was be a nurse. She was going to be a good nurse, you could tell. But there was no way she would get admitted anywhere. So my dad knew her well, and he said, "Come with me to whatever you call the admissions officers' meetings." I don't know, Dick might know, but Dick. So he took my friend, and she waited off stage, and he showed these admissions officers her high school scores and said how many of you would admit her to nursing school. Nobody. So he showed her ACT scores and said, "How many of you would admit her to nursing school?" Nobody. So he invited her out for an interview in front of the people, and then asked how many of you would admit her, and everybody. She went on to become supervisor of nurses at one of the biggest hospitals in Phoenix and working on the governor's panel for health services. So she called me when she heard he died and said, I would never have been a nurse without him. So. Oh, and one other one that, yeah. I mean, we could tell. When you think forward thinking, I mean, it didn't even, all these pieces didn't even fall together for me until years later, but Pop taught industrial arts, which is a guy thing, you know, back in our day. The boys took industrial arts, and the girls took home ec. But Pop and this young home ec teacher, Joe Woods, in Smith Center, said, why does it have to be that way? We need to get some of the girls doing industrial arts if they want to, and some of the boys doing home ec. And they were way ahead of their time in trying to do that. And that's just, that was the good part of Smith Center. I mean, there was a lot of that happening. On the note of home economics, Nancy and I were up all night cooking. So you have homemade cookies, coffee and tea. Enjoy and, you know, share more stories and get to know one another and find out more about how Dawn and Jean impacted your lives. And we thank you for coming.
Get the mic back. Dawn's favorite book may have been The Little Prince, and so I offer a reading from the end of that book. The words of the little prince as it comes time for his departure. I too am going back home today. It is much farther, it is much more difficult. I realized closely that something extraordinary was happening. I was holding him close in my arms as if he were a little child, and yet it seemed to me that he was rushing headlong toward an abyss from which I could do nothing to restrain him. I felt myself frozen by the sense of something irreparable, and I knew that I could not bear the thought of never hearing that laughter anymore. But he said to me, "Tonight it will be a year. My star, then, can be found right above the place where I came to the earth a year ago. The thing that is important is the thing that is not seen. It is just as it is with the flower. If you love a flower that lives on a star, it is sweet to look at the sky at night. And at night, all the stars are abloom with flowers. And you'll look up at the stars. Where I live, everything is so small that I cannot show you where my star is to be found. It is better like that. My star will be just one of the stars for you. And you will love to watch all the stars in the heavens. They will all be your friends. In one of the stars I shall be living. In one of them I shall be laughing. And so it will be as if all the stars were laughing when you look at the sky at night. You, only you, will have the stars that can laugh." And he laughed again. "And when your sorrow is comforted, time soothes all sorrows. You will be content that you have known me. You will always be my friend. You will want to laugh with me, and you will sometimes open your window for that pleasure, and your friends will be properly astonished to see you laughing as you look up in the sky." So as the little prince tells us, time soothes, and when your sorrow is comforted, you will be content that you knew Don Gabby Davis. Now we bid farewell to him. We have only the memories, the stories. The baseball games are long over. The lively discussions over drinks have ended. We'll never know how many students Don influenced. We do know he was loved deeply. We know that because of your presence here. And as we remember Don, we will strive to live into our own best selves, knowing that in time, his destiny is our own. In the meantime, we will treasure the gifts of this life, learn from his example of independence, open-mindedness, and determination. And as we hold on to those values we've learned from Don, we will keep him alive in our hearts. I leave you with the words of Carl Sandburg. Gather the stars if you wish it so. Gather the songs and keep them. Gather the faces. Gather for keeping years and years, and then loosen your hands. Let go and say goodbye. Let the stars and songs go. Let the faces and years go. Loosen your hands and say goodbye. The family will greet you in the Alsop room, where there's ice cream and cookies.